I defend every single word of the dossier. I defend every single part of the process.
No ambiguity there. He just isn't sorry. On today's Politics Weekly, we're picking apart Alistair Campbell's appearance in front of the Chilcot inquiry. Also on today's show, we're discussing a flurry of Liberal Democrat interventions. And then finally, we're going to take some lessons in morality from very unlikely teachers. I'm Allegra Stratton, and today on Politics Weekly, I've got Polly Toynbee, Madeleine Bunting and Geoffrey Wheatcroft. We're going to go straight into the Alistair Campbell appearance at the Iraq War inquiry. It was quite astonishing and included the reminder that secret correspondence had passed between Bush and Blair. Despite that, Campbell insisted that they all had clean hands.
If Saddam Hussein did comply with the United Nations obligations, if Hans Blix had been able to say, yes, I've been there, I've seen the lot, I've seen where all the leftovers are, I've been through right through the clusters document, we've got all the paper, we've seen all the evidence, he's got rid of a lot of it, Saddam Hussein, that would have been regime change in that it would have been a different sort of regime. Now, so I don't accept, you seem to be wanting me to say that Tony Blair signed up to saying, look, well, regardless of the facts, regardless of WMD, we're just going to get rid of the guy. It was not like that.
One paper gave him 5 out of 5, Geoffrey. What did you give him?
Well, 5 out of 5 for chutzpah.
Yeah.
He is amazing in his effrontery and impenitence and bluster. But it's not good enough. Well, I mean, that's not good enough. It was also completely ghastly. I didn't know about the others. I watched with horrified fascination, you know, weeping for my country, to think this man had actually been very close to the centre of power and had helped take us into a needless and illegal war.
Madeleine, 5 out of 5 or 0 out of 5 or...?
Does it say that it sort of reflects my kind of low opinion of the political process that it requires certainty? If you're going to play the political game, you don't admit to doubt or self-question.
His appearance reaffirmed that, or his having ever been part of it.
He's symptomatic of a political culture that we've got, and you know the reason why that is so. He could not have done that performance in any other way, I think. I think it's naive to think that somehow he was going to say, actually, I've had second thoughts, I've thought about this again, and maybe we weren't right. That kind of human possibility of self-questioning seems to have been totally sort of squeezed out of our political culture, and that's partly because the media jump on any second thought. You know, in the privacy of his great, most intimate relationships, can Alistair Campbell say, well, maybe there were other things we could have done, we've thought about this in a different way? Possibly, but he's not going to do that in public. You know, get real. We'd have, you know, the headlines would have been horrific.
But that means don't do the inquiry, doesn't it?
Well, I think it just illustrates how impoverished our kind of debate and political culture is. And I know this is a sort of useless hand-wringing exercise, but it does mean that there's a kind of, you know, dishonesty, it seems to me, that's sort of riddled through how we talk about all the kind of major events of our country.
You're smiling, Polly. Did Alistair get away with it, or do you think that the ladies and gentlemen of the inquiry were sitting there thinking, you think you've got away with this, and actually you've hung yourself and you don't even realise how?
I was glad he stuck to his guns. I felt there was a certain honesty in it. I think his stomach would have really turned if he'd suddenly said, actually, I think we got it wrong, and, you know, Tony Blair deceived me. I think the parade of really shabby evidence we've seen has been from a whole lot of people washing their hands of responsibility when they should have resigned. If Jeremy Greenstock thought it was illegal and wrong, he should bloody well have stood up and resigned. Christopher Mayer's shameful performance, one after another, of these people who were intimately involved. All right, they were civil servants, but there really is a point when it comes to going to war where that's nothing to do with it. If you think you are helping take your country to a wrong and illegal war, you resign and you make a fuss and you be brave. I think one civil servant did at the time, fairly junior in the Foreign Office, and that was all. And I think what we've seen has been disgraceful, and I'm quite glad to have Campbell reminding us of what they thought were the arguments at the time in favour, wrong though they were, and also not turning around and dumping on his boss. You know, Blair was fundamentally wrong, did it for all of the wrong reasons. But nevertheless, he plainly thought it was right because there was no political mileage in it for him. There was nothing to gain. He was just outrageously wrong. And everybody else has now run away and left him to it. And I think it's been a despicable spectacle from beginning to end so far.
Well, I think it's been... I totally agree about the self-serving evidence of all the previous witnesses who have been very crummy. But it is a reminder of, first of all, we've just heard this cacophonous noise of people settling the score and getting their own back with Blair. And yet, of course they should have resigned en masse, but it is a reminder of what a weird episode it was in historical terms. I mean, we had a period of almost personal rule, like the Stuart monarchs under Blair and his tiny little group of cabal who were ruling the country. I don't think most Labour MPs wanted the Iraq War. I don't think most members of the cabinet probably really wanted it. They all rolled over. They allowed him to get away with it. The war was, without question, unwanted by every ambassador in the Foreign Service.
Conservatives quite wanted it. They probably believed it more than Labour did.
The Tories, only because the Tories, whom I could not be more critical of myself, though remember that there were a few Tories who did oppose the war, and it's not insignificant that they were senior former cabinet ministers, like Ken Clark, Rifkin, Hurd, even John Gummer, even Douglas Hogg, who, it should not be forgotten at this rather low point in his fortunes, was one of the tellers for the eyes in the rebel amendment in March 2003 in the Commons. But that's one thing. They all capitulated to Blair at the time. So what had gone wrong with the democratic government in this country? The other thing, though, is very well to say that, I mean, I agree, it may make a refreshing change to see Campbell being so impenitent. Not that he was going to play the same part as people like Christopher Mayer. He was obviously never going to do that. Nor, as I was saying to somebody in New York the other day, do I think we are going to see from Tony Blair that Bateman cartoon of the criminal who admitted everything. You know, he's not going to go in front of Chilcot and say, of course I made the whole thing up. But the other thing about Campbell's testimony was that he actually confirmed the central charge against Blair. Our late and much missed colleague, Hugo Young, had been a great admirer of Blair's. He wrote a series of brilliant pieces before his very sad death at the end of 2003 about Iraq. And in one of them, there was a sentence which has to be reprinted daily, I think, when Hugo Young said, the great overarching fact about Iraq, which Tony Blair will never admit but cannot convincingly deny, is that the decision for war was taken much earlier than he says it was. And everything else about WMD, Blix, the lot, really evaporates at that point. The only real question is, when was the decision for war taken?
And in The Guardian were all writing that already. This is a done deal. We know that's what he's pushing for. We know that's what he wants, really. It's not as if, for a lot of us who were opposed to the war, it comes as a sort of stunning revelation.
Madeline, what Nick Clegg did quite well this week, which we'll come on to his week later, but he succeeded in turning what was an historical exercise into a current problem, which is we still don't know what Gordon Brown thought. Does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of thinking, does it matter in all kinds of ways? Does it matter in electoral terms? Does it matter to the voter? Does it matter to us truly understanding what happened in the Iraq War, what happened in the cabinet? There are so many different ways of answering that, because in a way it's lots of different questions. Does it matter at the ballot box in May? I don't know. You know, one's back into this territory of what the Labour MPs were always telling us, which is on the doorstep, people don't care about Iraq anymore. You know, it's a sort of short attention span issue. I think the question that the Jeffrey's raising, which is how is it that Blair managed to convince the cabinet, convince his party to go along with it? You know, I think that is the most interesting question.
OK, well, there's more commentary on the Chilcot inquiry on our website, and you can be sure that Andy Sparrow is going to be picking it apart in real time on his blog. That's all at guardian.co.uk/politics. So we've heard quite a bit from Clegg on Iraq, but the Lib Dem leader started the week dumping his spending commitments. Not a great start. But since then has been busy making up for it. Julian Glover tells us what he thinks Clegg is up to.
By clearing the decks, he wants to make the party look credible, and he's hoping that it will win support from people because they think the Lib Dems are actually telling the truth. Nick Clegg's real claim at the next election is he's going to lead the most radical party. He'll say, I'm really going to do the things that Labour's tried to talk about doing but hasn't ever managed. So he wants to raise the tax threshold for income tax to £10,000. So that takes a lot of low-paid people largely out of income tax, some out of it altogether. Now, that's very expensive, very radical. It will obviously help everybody who pays income tax, but particularly helps the poor. Big piece of redistribution. No other parties dared do. So he wants to use things like that. He wants to use a radical agenda on the Constitution. and what he says is a radical investment in schools to show his party has strong commitments to very narrow, specific things. It's not just a sprawling mass of good ideas. Lib Dem manifestos have never been short of good ideas, but they've been short of focus. He's trying to sharpen the edge. So he doesn't want to go into the next election looking like a soft party. He wants to be the tough party of change.
Polly, you are supposed to think that he's missing an opportunity.
Well, you know, they are the party of protest. They're what you vote for when you're very angry with the other two parties. On the whole, you don't expect them to be in power. Though this time, of course, what you'll want to know is what are their non-negotiables? And that's what he really needs to tell us. I need to know that proportional representation is an absolute non-negotiable. That he
you
will
don't
not...
think he says that enough already?
No, I don't think he does. I think he's quite uncertain himself because he knows it's not exactly top of the agenda with the public. It sounds a bit self-serving. So he's a bit worried about it sounding as if, well, we're only going to go into support any other party in power if we can get what will help us electorally. It sounds like old Westminster politics. Actually, it's as luckily at last a lot of Labour people are beginning to realise, you know, it is the only radical game changer that breaks open the old parties and allows new parties in and gives us a breath the fresh air and the stuffy air of Westminster. But on these spending commitments, it probably is sensible to say what, you know, if £10,000 base limit is non-negotiable, that's important. Very important, though, that which they haven't done, that they stop the middle classes benefiting from that. There has to be a cut-off. It can't be everybody's personal allowance, £10,000.
Geoffrey, I sort of struggle with Clegg because he goes around... last week he called the other parties corrupt, which I thought was quite alarming. I don't think we hear that kind of language that often. Maybe we should hear it more. But anyway, he nonetheless called them corrupt. But he goes around sort of insisting that he's not a cheap date and that he won't go into coalition with anybody, which I think is the kind of course he will. And so he's calling people, other politicians, duplicitous. And
I'm not saying I'm not very impressed by Clegg. I think he's one of the more disappointing leaders of our third party. He's just an unimpressive political personality. I mean, he's not stupid, but he's not... He's not something that my heart never leaps when I see him, must say, or hear him. And they've got all the old problems of the third party that they can go on endlessly producing policies, and yet they haven't been in office for 85 years, and so nobody there is an ultimate futility about every policy they propose. They want proportional representation, but I don't think they're going to get it at any rate. Not in those circumstances, because even if there isn't an absolute majority of the hung parliament we all talk about, I mean, it's quite possible that both the Tories and Labour will say, no, we're not going to give you this. We will not do that. Therefore, we'll have another election instead.
I think Labour would definitely give it, without a doubt, now. And when that, particularly after an election, when Brown would have gone... you know, Jack Straw, we hope, long last, will have gone, who's been the great obstacle to any kind of reform of any sort, whatever. And, you know, you've got the Milibands, you've got a whole string of them who are very much in favour of it.
Madeline, what are the other things?
Can I just interject? Because Polly has been telling us for years and years how important it is to get PR, not just in terms of abstract justice, but because you think it would produce a progressive coalition. But if any party at the moment should really be asking for some form of electoral reform, it is the Tories. People simply haven't grasped that the last election in England, as opposed to the United Kingdom, Labour won, I think, 90 seats more than the Tories, and the Tories won a large number of popular votes.
It used to be true of Labour in the 80s, and they wouldn't budge either, because these obstinate parties would rather be out of power for ages, as long as they can have absolute power when they finally, the pendulum swings back. Madness.
Madeline, the other thing that Clegg's done this week is he's done an interview with Attitude magazine, the gay magazine, and he's come out with a raft of pledges that he thinks will swing the pink vote. But what he's also trying to do with that is sort of stamp his feet on the territory of sort of just liberal voters. Do you think that there's an appetite for his brand of liberal politics that the others aren't tapping into?
Well, yeah, and also, interestingly, he sort of had his views on Gina Ford's baby methods as well. he's been sort of trying to, I think, put right the deficit that Geoffrey mentioned, which is that it's very, very hard to really get a sense of political personality from him at all.
That's because he is who he is, or because he's the leader of the third party?
No, I think it's because he is who he is. I find him astonishingly sort of wobbly in his kind of
delivery. I mean, the irony, of course, is that I think the Lib Dems elected him because they thought they had, you know, very much in the mould of Cameron, a very sort of telegenic, very sort of smooth communicator and operator. And to our amazement, actually, he's really not a very effective communicator.
No.
And Parliament, he stumbles again and again. I mean, this guy's been educated in all of these top elite schools to communicate seamlessly in the House of Commons. I mean, that's what Westminster education is designed to achieve, isn't it? And it's not actually working, and nor does he manage to convey any sense of actually being a sort of ordinary bloke, man of the people. That populism is not there. He, I'm afraid, comes across as very much of that sort of liberal, you know, public school educated elite. Quite cold, actually,
okay.
Quite chilly.
Well, having trashed Nick Clegg, we're going to move on to the man who's trying to nick lots of his votes and who made a speech on character this week. David Cameron said he made a very brave claim, which was that love is more important than poverty in raising a child. Polly, you didn't like it very much.
Well, it was interesting and clever because he is very deft and very intelligent and he makes good speeches. And he is like a sort of butterfly who just touches down on things and passes on. So he's adopted various sort of liberal and humane sounding things. But when you peel away the actual policy underneath, what he's saying is going back to very traditional Tory values, which is it's about rules in family life and about love in family life, and that's all that matters. And in a sense, that's true. But to simply say, well, if you strip away poverty, it's such an enormous predictor of how families are, how they've behaved for generations, how they grow up, what their background, their environment is, that it's a sort of nonsense to say, well, when you strip that away, let's look at what really matters.
Just very quickly, did he distort or misunderstand the original research? Or?
Yes, three pieces of research recently he has absolutely disgracefully distorted, picks it up, mentions it, everybody goes, oh, he's absorbed, you know, the spirit level by Wilkinson and Pickett, for instance, and then he completely dismisses it and goes against its central tenets.
But Madeline, it's a good thing to have him talking about character, isn't it?
Well, I completely agree with Polly about the way the Tories are distorting this kind of research and deeply troubled by it. But what I find frustrating is how Labour seems to have a sort of tin ear to the kinds of sort of social cultural contexts in which material conditions are absolutely central. So how do you bring the two together? That, you know, solving poverty is not just about material issues, it's also about cultural and social issues as well. And you know, I find that there's a sort of strange gap in Labour thinking, which is part of what Cameron is now exploiting, which is it sounded too materialist, i.e. there's only one solution here, just, you know, sort out poverty and hey presto, you've sorted out, you know, all kinds of other issues. And that's clearly not the case, because actually you get very bad parenting in very wealthy households. What is it about parenting and how do you encourage good parenting? Now, I think Labour's got a story to tell here. It's just not been very good at doing it. Sure Start, in many parts of its programming, is about helping people to be really good parents. What does that entail? So there's a frustration that the politicians got completely wrapped up in a kind of managerialist language within government, which has sounded just so lacking human engagement and human values. And that, I think, is where Cameron's driving a coach and horses through. And it's rubbish what he's saying, but it sounds good.
He's going to cut Sure Start. And if you sit through the parenting classes in Sure Start, they are so moving and so good. And the discussions that they have together are really good. And you feel this is something that really can transform the way people react with their children without anybody bossing them, or, you know, it's
we have the
testimony of parents.
Audacity?
Who say exactly that? It's transforming.
I'm struck by Cameron's audacity because Polly calls him a butterfly, who is a jackdaw. I mean, he picks up bits and pieces here and there. I think when I hear this kind of speech from him, I wish he'd remember what Mr. McMillan, a previous Tory leader, said: if people want moral guidance, they should look to their bishops, not their politicians.
Yeah, and but the bishops don't provide it anymore. That's why the politicians have such a struggle.
Moral lectures of any kind, or anything touching on family morality, is a very tricky subject for politicians.
So don't do it.
Well,
I
think I would. Yeah, I mean, I would, if I were he, I'd certainly keep clear of that whole subject. And, or perhaps he's seen Of Thee I Sing, which was the Gershwin Brothers musical. I just remembered this, actually. It was put on last year, 1932, I think. It was a satire on American electoral politics in which the winning candidate is love.
Well, he did say, hold on, Cameron has said, let sunshine win the day. It is not that far-fetched that he will say, let love win the day.
What a completely meaningless load of rubbish.
No, indeed. And he dropped it. We haven't heard that from him since until this week.
Well, it's austerity now, and we know what austerity means. We've been there, we've had it.
But indeed, and then the polls started to narrow, and one of the reasons was thought to be that they were being too gloomy. So he's sort of vacillating all over the place in where he's trying to position himself on sort of moral, non-political values. But will people listen, Geoffrey? Will they?
I don't think it makes any difference, actually. I mean, I'm not being cynical about this. I think that practically nothing said by any of the party leaders between now and the 6th of May is going to make any difference. I mean, people have decided. unless we go to war with Lithuania and lose, I don't think much.
They've decided.
That is generally true, actually, that election campaigns have been shown to have very little effect on the outcome of
the
election.
Unless there's very few points in it.
Well, that's true.
Possibly but where in 92, I think it moved at the last minute.
That is true.
But that's rare, you're right.
That is true. And it was a very curious election, of course, for all sorts of reasons. And possibly it was lost by Tony Blair's analysis, as you must know, is that it was lost for Labour by John Smith.
Well, on that note of absolute pessimism, we're going to end it. My partner in podcasting, Tom Clark, is going to be back with me next time. Thank you to Geoffrey Wheatcroft, Polly Toynbee and Madeline Bunting for joining us this week. I'm Alex Stratton, and the producer was Francesca Panetta.